This is a test, one, two, three.
We'll call the Committee on Employee Benefits Programs to order and ask council to call the roll.
Thank you, Senators Dever.
Here.
Stoser.
Here.
Krebsbaum. O'Connell.
Aye.
Pullman. Triplett. Representatives Vigasa.
Here.
Fanning.
Here.
Robin.
Here.
Doctor.
Here.
Hake.
Here.
Louser.
Here.
And Onsted.
And you all should have, okay, we do have a quorum. You all should have received the minutes by email two or three days ago, I think.
So moved.
We have a motion and a second to approve the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion's carried. Comments by Chairman, I just like to mention, during the last meeting, we had a vote on a bill, and there was a motion for a favorable recommendation that failed, and then a motion for an unfavorable recommendation that failed, and then I called for a motion for no recommendation. And somebody asked, I think Senator Triplett asked, what happens if that failed? Well, actually, I think the no recommendation is a default, and it was probably unnecessary that we even take that vote. So in the future, that's what, unless there's any objection or any other insight, that's how I'm going to handle it. So the minutes appropriately reflect what happened, but next time it's not going to happen that way. We have this morning three different bills, two bills that we have taken possession of in before and sent to the actuary, and we're going to get the report. We have another bill coming up that we will consider accepting jurisdiction of and sending that off to the actuary. The 1105 item, we're going to roll that into our discussion of bill draft number 176, which is on your, in front of you as Senate Bill 2038. And just so you know, Century Code says that you cannot introduce a bill until, or that has an impact on the PERS fund until, unless it has a report from the Employee Benefits Committee. So that's not actually a bill because it doesn't have that yet. Let the minutes reflect that Senator Krebsbach has joined us. So with that, looking at the 1115 item, and I should mention that there is another event taking place in this room at 12:15, so we will not extend our meeting any longer than necessary. But I want to make sure that any questions that you may have of anybody are answered and we have a fair understanding. So with that, Sparb, do you want to visit with us about the group insurance?
Yes, I'll just give you a quick update. Here's the handout on group insurance. The other handout you're getting is on the goal of gravity. But Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you know, the group health insurance plan is, we've talked about that at previous meetings. It is out for bid. What I handed out to you is the schedule going forward from today. We have a board meeting on December 4th. At that time, the board will be taking a look at some contracts for PBMs and sending those out. We hope to get those responses and review all the RFPs we received by the December 18th meeting of the board. They'll review it there, and then we'll try and select who to come in for interviews. And that will be, by target date is January 5th, and our target date for a decision is the January board meeting. On the back here, I've just given you kind of the decision process that's laid out here. We bid it out on a fully insured basis and a self-insured basis. We got proposals on both, the fully insured and the self-insured. And at the end of the day, we go through, find out what the best fully insured is, compare that to the best self-insured, and underneath the legislative guidelines you've provided to us, we can only accept a self-insured proposal if it is deemed to be more cost-effective for an equivalent contract benefits than the fully insured. And so that's the process we'll be going through. And we did get two medical proposals in, and we got about four PBM proposals in. And the two medical are both fully insured and self-insured. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a quick overview of where we're at.
Those contracts run on a biennial basis?
They run on a biennial basis. Underneath statute, though, if we go self-insured, we only renew that every 4 years, statute directs. And what we've done on the fully insured plan is we've done that on a 6-year basis in the past. During the interim, we have just renewals, not full bids.
Sure. Does anyone have any questions of SPARB regarding the group health insurance plan? Thank you, SPARB. Next is under consideration is our 1125 item. And I don't see Representative Casper.
He wasn't expecting to be here before the time periods. He'll be here before 1125.
Okay, do we have the bill in front of us? I wonder, we should maybe come back to that.
He is planning to come down.
Okay. Let's move then to the 1135 item and consideration of bill draft number 117.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, bill number 117 is a bill that's been before you during the interim. There was an amendment to the bill at the last committee meeting, and that amendment just basically said that this would not be deemed a mandate. With that amendment, you asked the actuary to take another look at the bill to see if that changed any of the findings in the bill that you previously reviewed. You'll note here that the review that you have is the same as before. It's just been updated with a more current date, recognizing that they took a look at the change and it hasn't made any adjustments to the bill. So the change didn't affect the review, which is basically, to the extent there is any cost, it's a very minimal cost to the plan to provide this service. And so, Mr. Chairman, basically, the report you previously heard on this stands. This remains pretty much the same, even with the amendment that was adopted last time.
Okay. Are there any questions of the committee? I think we had a pretty good discussion of this the first time that we heard it, and there's not been much change to it. Is there any other discussion on this before we entertain a motion? And the chair would entertain a motion for recommendation on bill number 117 for a favorable recommendation. Okay, we have a motion by Senator O'Connell with a second by Representative Doctor to place a favorable recommendation on bill number 117. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll ask council to call the roll.
Senators Kilzer?
Aye.
Krebsma?
Aye.
O'Connell?
Aye.
Pullman?
Aye.
Triplett?
Aye.
Representatives Vigasa?
Yes.
Fanning? Fanning?
Aye.
Robin?
Yes.
Doctor?
Yes.
Hake?
Aye.
Lausser?
Yes.
Onstead? And Senator Dever?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Motion is carried. So that bill will go forward with the we'll go back to Representative Maragos, who has the option of introducing it, but it will have a favorable recommendation on the report. Let's go ahead and jump into Bill 176, and if somebody would inform Representative Casper when he arrives that we delayed it, we didn't dispatch it.
Okay.
his bill. So, Brad, if you want to...
Sure, I know how to do this here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Ramirez. I'm the, with Siegel Company, which is the consultant and actuary for the PERS plan. You requested that we analyze Bill 176, and we have done so, and prepared a lengthy letter for you that was dated November 26th. So you probably have that letter in front of you, and like I said, it's quite big. We're going to go through some of the highlights of that letter. We realize that we're very pressed for time, so I'm going to go as quickly as you'll let me.
I want to make sure that even though we have time constraints, that everyone has an understanding of, so...
Absolutely.
Don't let the clock...
Got it.
Cut anybody short.
I will certainly try to make you understand or help you understand our analysis. So, quickly looking at the proposed bill, what the bill does is essentially close off the state portion of the hybrid plan. And when I say hybrid plan, I mean PERS plan. So I use those sort of interchangeably in this presentation. And allow political subdivisions, which make up about 50% of the plan, to continue as unchanged. Temporary state employees that are hired after 12/31/15 will only be able to participate in the DC plan. State employees that are currently participating in the hybrid plan, the DB plan, hired before January 1st, 16. So everyone who's hired after January 1st, 16 would go into the new DC plan. People who are currently there or hired before that point would have the option to transfer to the DC plan. So they would take their defined benefit assets and liabilities and move them into the DC plan. So that's how this one is a little different than ones that we've looked at in past years. Contribution rates for the new state employees to the DC plan would be the same contribution rates as they are currently for the DB plan. So for the PERS main members, I believe the amount is 14.12% of pay that would go into the DC plan. The vesting period, which is the period at which it takes to earn a non-forfeiture benefit or an unforfeitable benefit, would be 100% vesting after 1 year of service, which is a little bit less than the current plan. The current plan, it takes longer for you to accrue benefits under or accrue non-forfeitable benefits under the DB plan. The bill draft would not affect Supreme Court, district judges, employees eligible, National Guard, law enforcement, et cetera, so this would focus only on the PERS main state employees. And as we said, that's about between 45 and 55% of the group, the PERS group, main group. One thing that we notice right away is that the bill does not provide a funding mechanism for the transfer. There will be some costs associated with this bill. And you can see the note that was prepared by legislative council staff. There are a couple other bills that we understand that would provide a side funding mechanism outside of the plan. And there are some issues there that we'll discuss later. But the bill in and of itself does not provide funding for the change. So here's the actuarial review. And what we're going to look at is, in order to fund the bill, remember, we're funding pension benefits with contributions, and when you cut off a source of contributions, which is future members to the plan, so right now there's a certain assumption for future members of the plan. If we say that people are no longer to be coming into the plan, that source of revenue is no longer there. And so while the costs don't necessarily increase, you're decreasing the contributions that you expected to come into the plan later. So that's really the source of the cost. We're looking at a couple of ways. One is a single contribution. So if we shut down the plan or close the plan to these members, what would the one-time contribution need to be in order that the plan would never run out of money? And I use never in quotes because, you know, this is a projection. There are lots of moving parts. But the idea is, what would be sufficient if we put in the amount of money, a certain set amount of money and a certain date that we would expect, in, you know, there'd be a 50% likelihood or more, that the fund would never exhaust itself before the last benefit was paid. We also looked at that in terms of a contribution increase, rather than a one-time contribution, maybe a contribution increase that would do the same thing. And remember, this contribution increase is based on a dwindling number of people, because the number of people that's in the plan is going to get smaller and smaller as time goes on. So that we looked at that as well. We also discussed the investment return issues and issues under GASB, which is the state accounting, or the Accounting Standards Board, which governs how the state will put this on their books. So we have these pretty rainbow charts, and there are a bunch of these. And what these are, this is the contribution required, single lump sum contribution. And there's a lot of numbers there, so I'll go through this one slowly and see if we can do the other ones quicker. This assumes the four different contribution dates. So the first one will be January 1st, 2016, July 1st, 2016, January 1st, 2017, and July 1st, 2017. And you can see that what will happen is, as the longer it takes for you to put in that lump sum, the effect of interest makes it so that you have to put a little bit more in because of the passage of time. So that's what that is. The rates of return are really the crucial assumption that you have to make when you do these projections. And keep in mind that, you know, if you ask 10 actuaries to do this number, you probably get 10 different numbers. But the magnitude, hopefully the magnitude, if our assumptions and methods are sound, would be similar or would be very close. And I think we saw that over the summer. We had our numbers reviewed, and they had some by a different firm. Different firm had slightly different methodology, and so we had different numbers. But I think we were able to agree at the end of the day that, okay, neither is right or wrong. You know, there's assumptions that may be good or assumptions that may be bad. The key is really that percentage return assumption. Right now, the plan assumes an 8% rate of return in perpetuity. So the plan, you know, some years are going to be higher, some years are going to be lower, but we expect the rate of return on average to be 8%. What happens if, rather than 8%, those numbers, maybe we earn at 7% every year, or 6% every year, or 5% every year, and you notice that they're going that way. The numbers obviously get bigger as you go. And we'll talk about why it may make sense to use one of those lower numbers later. But the idea is, if you assume an 8% rate of return from now until perpetuity, and the fund, you want the fund to never run out of money, on January 1st, 2016, a $67.4 million one-time contribution would be sufficient to make sure that the fund doesn't run out of money with a 50% likelihood. So it's possible that the number could be higher or lower based on returns, but if you average 8%, that number would be about there. You can see the magnitude of the changes as you go from 8% to 7% and 7% to 6%. Those numbers go up, $393 million, $803 million, $1.3 billion, $2 billion. So this is the formula for all of these tables that we're going to look at. Now, one thing I'll note about this page, at this point on this assumption, we've assumed that no people leave the plan from DB to DC. And keep in mind that they have that option. Now, it's highly unlikely that no people will leave. We probably expect people will leave. In fact, we think a bunch of people are probably going to leave if that happens, because they're going to have the option of moving to DC. A lot of people find DC attractive. What happens if people start to leave? Well, here we assume 40%. 40% move from DB to DC. And we're not sure who's going to do it, so we just assumed, all right, 40% of the liabilities go away and 40% of the assets go away. What happens to the contributions? Well, what happens is the contributions go up, or the contribution that's needed to keep the plan stable or keep the plan from running out of money actually goes up on the 8% return. And the reason that it goes up is because you're taking away, not only are you taking away the assets and the liabilities, you're also taking away a source of future contributions, because those people aren't there anymore. So, okay, the numbers go up a little bit. The numbers actually go down on the 7%, 6%, 5%, which is kind of a quirky thing. And the reason that is because we're still assuming an 8% return. When we get a 7% return or a 6% return, we have a loss every year, and that loss ends up being needed to be paid for. The fewer people that are in the plan, the lower that loss is. And so it's actually more beneficial for the plan for everyone to leave if you're not going to earn 8%, or more people to leave if you're not going to earn 8%. You're still going to have a large gap, but the gap isn't as big. So it's just kind of a quirky thing actuarially. What if 80% leave? Well, I'll just go back to the number real quick. 92.9 million baseline. 8% return if you put it in on January 1st, 2016, 92.9 million. You can see how that number goes up. What if 80% of the people leave? That number becomes 118.3 million. Further, more less assets and liabilities, but less future contributions, and so that 118.3 million is the number that you're left with. Okay? So the question is, well, you know, how many people are going to leave? And we don't know the answer, but we can tell you the magnitude of what that number is going to be, 40%, 80%, or none. Okay, this is the...
May I interrupt?
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Ramirez, your company obviously works in a variety of states, right?
Yes.
And so you see a lot of other examples. Can't you be closer? I mean, can't you make tighter predictions than 0 to 40 to 80% based on what you see in other states in terms of the desirability of a defined benefit versus a defined contribution?
I would say that the 40% number is based on the experience that we've gotten from SPARB and staff. The 40% number is probably the closest. I mean, I would sort of say I would lean toward maybe a little less than 40. You know, if I had to guess, and, you know, my life depended on it, I would probably say 30 to 35. But
if I may follow up then, just so the 0 and the 80 are clearly outliers in your mind.
They are. What they do, though, is they give you the magnitude of the difference. So you can say, you know, I know that, you know, if 40 is right, then, okay, here's what the number is. If 80 is right, then here's what the number is. So you know that the number is probably going to be somewhere in between those two. So, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Do we allow that option in a window?
Yes. Yes.
So at the end of that window, we know.
That's correct.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. And this is something that we would definitely, if this were put into effect, it would take a lot of analysis the first year or two to really get our arms around, okay, who left, you know, which people did, and then we would have a very clear picture of the liability from that point, because once that point is over, we know the group that's in the plan, and that's the only people that are ever going to be in the plan again. So the liability at that point will be very easy to predict. It's more difficult to predict who's going to leave it, you know, before they're given the option.
And considering other states, I think a lot of states have considered making this kind of a move, but not many have. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. Transfers from DB to DC are pretty uncommon. We've seen typically when a DC is put in or a hybrid arrangement is put in, there's either a fixed date at which everyone must participate in the DC or hybrid, or there's an option where when a person comes in, they can participate in Plan A or Plan B. Plan A would be a DB plan. Plan B would be some sort of hybrid arrangement.
Okay.
Okay, so the flip side is if we're not going to do another way to fund this rather than a single lump sum payment would be a contribution increase that's ongoing. And this would be, remember, just for the people who are staying in the plan. So the people that don't leave and the people that are in that closed group. That group is smaller than projected currently, right? Because there's less people in the plan. So they have a bigger share of that unfunded liability that's out there. And so these are the amounts, if no people leave the plan today, these are the amounts that you would see under the various return scenario. And you can see the, you know, for example, if on January 1st, 2016, we projected a contribution increase that would cover the bill, it would be approximately 1.59% of pay. And that's what we would expect with 50% likelihood would pay for the plan under an 8% assumption. Of course, if the assumption is 7, 6, 5, or 4, less asset returns means that more contributions have to be put in, and so you would end up with an 8%, 60%, 24%, or 35%. So this is, once again, the assumption if no people leave the plan, if we move to 40% leaving the plan, the contribution increase would be approximately 3.39% as of 1/1/16 under the 8% assumption. And you can see how the numbers go up again. If you're not meeting that 8% losses build up, and you have to come up with that some other way. And the other way is through higher contributions. So this is the 40% number. If 80% leave, it's 9.47%. So you can see how that number swings. And that is very volatile, both on the amount of contributions, or both on the number of people that leave and the rate of return assumption. So hopefully you're getting a feel for how these numbers work. I know it's a lot. I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you, but those are the contribution increases. Another way to look at it would be, rather than using the funding mechanism that we have, or rather than using a contribution increase or a lump sum that would never, so that the plan would never run out of money, what if we forced the contribution to be fully fund the plan after 20 years? So remember, the last set of numbers I gave you, it was only so that the contribution would be sufficient so that the plan never ran out of money, which could be 30, 40, 50 years, because you have payments that are going on for that long. What if we said we want to be 100% funded in 20 years, period? Well, what are the contribution amounts? And the amounts on the bottom here are actually the same ones that you saw before. The boxes are actually where the contribution, the 20-year contribution would need to be. So we're comparing, if you look at the boxes that are floating above, before the number was 67.4, and that's how much it would be if the fund were to run down over 30, 40, 50 years. If you wanted to force it to be at 20 years, 100% funded, I have the number here and I'll give it to you, but you can see it's approximately $330 million. So you can see the difference. 67.4 million lump sum if you were going to let the fund wind down over time, but if you're going to force it after 20 years, it would be about $330 million. And you could see that's at 8%, 7% the number is $630 million, 6% it's almost $990 million, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, once again, if no one leaves the plan. This is the 0% leaves the plan, so skipping ahead to the 40% leave, which is probably the better guess, you can see how these numbers go up. For this group, I believe it's $375 billion, roughly, for 8%, and the numbers are in the table, but in the letter. But this is if 40% leave and you want to fund it over 20 years, $375 billion or so, up to $400 billion if you wait until July 2017 to do it. And once again, we have all the rates of return.
Brad, I'm a little bit confused.
Sure.
Does the $67.4 million correlate to the $160 million that you talked about before and the $301 that Gallagher talked about?
That's correct. That's correct.
It does.
Yeah, and the reason that's lower, that's a great question. Why is that lower? But I think it was before, it was 162. The reason that's lower is that the fund had a really fantastic year in assets, as we talked about at the last meeting.
The $400 million that David said that we can't count until next year.
Right.
Start counting until next year.
Right.
Because of the rolling average.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes. So, yeah, that's right. That number has gone. And you can see, you see big swings in that number because of the leverage. You'll hear people say leverage, actuaries. And the reason those numbers change so much is you have two numbers that you're working with for this unfunded. One is the assets, and one is the liabilities. Both of those numbers are changing. And so when the assets have a really good year, they get much closer to the liabilities. And if the liabilities have a good year, then they go down. And on bad years, they both go in the wrong direction. And so that number really fluctuates, that unfunded liability. And so it's kind of a tough target to hit. If you're trying to fund an unfunded liability, you really got to work hard.
But then now we're basing these assumptions then on the market value of assets instead of the actuarial value.
In this case, what we're doing is the market value, we're looking at the market value over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the first few years, the actuarial value and the market value will be different, but after a few years, they get close together. And so the idea is, yeah, the market value is really the number that we're concerned with. Now, in the 20-year assumption, the actuarial value is a little more important, because it's, you're not as close after 20 years as you would be in after 50 years between the two, but that's a great point. Yeah. Yeah, you always have to keep in mind the market value as part of this.
Well, and I think based on the actuary value last time, you said our funded status is 64%, but based on the market value, it was 77%.
That's correct. That's correct. Yes. And this takes into account the fact that the market value is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we project the market value going forward. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so these are 20-year numbers, and this is if 40% people leave, like I mentioned, and so the numbers, you can see those boxes all move up because less people are there to contribute, and if 80% leave, the boxes go up. Okay? So those are the dizzying array of numbers. Another way to look at this, at the numbers that I just gave you, the 20-year estimated total contribution requirement to achieve 100% funding in 20 years, and MVA, that means market value, so we're forgetting about smoothing for now. The current system would be about 193, 16.74% of payroll. And what that number is that includes all the political subdivisions. These are the state people, but they're also getting subsidized a little bit by the political subdivisions. So when you group them all together, it brings their contribution rate down because they're sharing the load. When you move the political subdivisions out and treat them on their own, the contribution immediately goes up for state people. State people are just demographically more expensive under the plan than the political subdivision people are. If 40% of the people leave and 80% of the people leave, you can see the immediate contribution increases. So we'll go to 28 or 49. And this is, remember, funding over 20 years. I think I'm going to step aside for a moment and let people talk about the job service fund.
As Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you know, that one of the big variables here is the return assumption you use going forward. Is it 8? Is it 7? Is it 6? Is it 5? Is it 4? Is it 3? PERS today is an open plan, and so we use 8%, which is pretty much consistent with what other open plans do. If PERS becomes a closed plan, then you take a look at that return assumption. We have one closed plan that we operate today, and that's the Job Service Retirement Plan. We are just in the process of looking at that return assumption, and you can see here, this is over on the left-hand side, with the most recent things that we got from the company we're working with here, which is SEI, we're looking at dropping the return assumption in that plan to somewhere between 6% and 3%. That plan is 149% funded. If we drop it to 6, it'll go to 132% funded, 5, 124, 4, 117, and 3, 110. And by dropping it, then the investment strategy will change. We'll move over to more fixed income, and there'll be less risk. And risk becomes more important when the plan has an end date than when it's open. When it's open, it's vesting into perpetuity. When we close it, it's kind of like being in a DC plan. Now all of a sudden you're 50 years old or 55 years old. Risk becomes more of a concern. When you're vesting like in perpetuity, it's like you're 25 years old forever. You don't have that same thing. So that's what we're doing with the job service plan. So if you look at that, we'll be going down somewhere probably in that 6 to 3% range. The other thing we did as part of the study is we asked Callan to look at what the effect on a closed plan would be. And David will review that information from the memo that we have there on return assumptions. And I'll hand one out for you, Sue.
Thank you very much, Barb. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Hunter. I serve as the Chief Investment Officer and Executive Director of the North Dakota Retirement Investment Office, and I've had the pleasure of doing so for the past year. Barb is handing out, it's about a 6 or 7 page memo. There's a lot of numbers and details in it. I'm just going to highlight the key points to it. What we asked Callan to do was to say, what is the reasonableness of our return assumption today and then going forward? And on page 6 of the presentation, there's a conclusion. And the conclusion that Callan states is that an 8% return assumption today, with the PERS plan being open, is very reasonable because we have a very long-term investment horizon. It's very good to compare and contrast that with a job service plan. If we were to adopt a plan to close the PERS plan, we would effectively be shortening the investment time horizon going forward. By doing that, we would need to reassess what is our kind of asset allocation mix going forward. Currently, we have a 57% allocation to equities, a 22% allocation to fixed income, 20% to real assets, and 1% to cash. That generates an 8% long-term expected rate of return. If we were over the very long term, over 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80-year time frame, if we were to adopt measures to close the plan, we would want to shorten our time horizon, and it would cause us to move away from kind of risk-seeking assets, out of equities, more into fixed income, investments that have still good investment return potential, but have significant less volatility, and that would take down our investment return assumption. That's a very involved process. It would probably involve, you know, dropping it by, you know, at least a half to 1% kind of going forward. That type of decision-making process is something that we have to just work with our investment consultants, work with our actuaries to say what's the right kind of long-term investment return assumption going forward if we were to adopt a closed plan going forward. Just briefly, just to highlight again, so right now our 8% return assumption in our current plan count gives us a memo about 8 pages in length, and the key conclusion is that an 8% return assumption in the current environment of an open plan is reasonable. It's slightly higher than the median. The median for public U.S. pension plans is the most recent estimate was about between 7.7 and 7.8%. So we're pretty close to that. If you look at PERS investment returns going back over the last 30 years, our actual PERS net investment returns actually exceeded over 9.3%, which is quite strong. So feel very comfortable with that 8% return equation going forward. But if we were to adopt some type of a form of a closed plan, it would cause us to have to reassess kind of our return expectation going forward, similar to what we're doing with kind of the job service plan going forward now where we're looking at rates as low as between 6 and 3% in the future.
So does this bill, which would close the plan to new hires, half the employees on the plan, dictate a change in investment strategy?
It would very likely trigger a review of our overall investment allocation and an asset liability kind of study. So we are actually kind of coming up on about a 5-year time frame in which we review our asset liabilities every 5 or so years. So yes, it would dictate kind of a review of our long-term asset return assumptions.
And who makes that decision?
We would work with the PERS board and the state investment board to develop a kind of new investment allocation strategy going forward.
There isn't any federal requirement or anything like that that would require you to adopt a more cautious investment strategy?
We would obviously work with our investment consultants, with our actuaries, who actually provide letters that basically say the reasonableness of our long-term return assumptions. So although, quote-unquote, there's no federal regulatory authority that specifically states they're signing off on an 8% return assumption or something lower than that going forward, the basis for us to achieve kind of clean audit opinions and clean actuarial findings reports kind of dictate that we assess our long-term return expectations in light of our overall kind of asset liability goals.
So would we consider that then to be a half-closed plan?
We would, even if we had a half-closed plan, we'd kind of reassess kind of the impact of that. It's a very involved process that we would work with our actuaries to make sure that we have it well determined in advance.
Okay. I don't see any other questions.
Very good. Thank you very
much.
Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to talk very briefly. I'm going to probably only take about 5 more minutes of your time. I know you have other things to get to. First off, the GASB, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, has promulgated new accounting standards for public sector plans and their employers. And I talked about that a little bit at the last meeting when we went over the valuation results. The current liabilities, as we see them, for the plans are listed above, and keep in mind these are not for funding purposes. This has nothing to do with funding policy. This is purely for financial statements. If you look at the main
group, the group that would be closed, the total pension liability would be, is currently $2.8 billion, and the fiduciary net position, which is the assets, is about $2.2 billion, which gives you a net pension liability of $634 million. What we would expect if that group started to leave, and the assets would, some of the liabilities would go away and some of the assets would go away, but over time we would expect that number possibly to go up as a result of the bill. Now, this is something that we'd have to look at over time. One big thing that would change, it would certainly change, is if we use, if we lower our rate of return assumption, we would most likely have to lower our discount rate for the total pension liability. And what that would do is it would make that, immediately it would make that total pension liability go up. So I just mentioned that that's one other issue. The accounting statements of the state and the employers would have, would show an effect for this bill. Now, in the plan, in the letter that I'm sure you've read, and you probably take it to bed with you at night and read it, there are a lot of issues that we bring up, and it's sort of a scattershot group of issues that we could think of along with this. And I'll just go through them pretty quickly. One big one is the proposed funding method. You know, as we said, the bill doesn't have a, doesn't currently have a funding method. If money is set aside but it's not in the trust, there are issues with that. Of course, the big issue is that if the plan is, if you're funding pension benefits outside of the trust, you have an issue with, you know, are these benefits going to be there, or are those plan, all those funds going to be there for the necessary time it takes to pay all the benefits? You know, in 10, 15, 20 years, will a different future legislature decide that they don't want that money to go to pension plans anymore? They want it to go to something else. And if it's not in the pension trust, there are security issues with that. So I'll leave it at that. Adequacy of benefits, we talk a little bit about DB versus DC. Most studies show that DC benefits aren't as efficient in delivering benefits, so you have to put in a little bit more for a DC benefit to get a comparable benefit to a DB plan. We did a study in 2000, I think we updated it in July of 2013. We're due to update it again, where we compare the participants who are in the DC plan currently versus what benefit they would have if they had been in the DB plan the whole time. And typically, 75 to 90% of the people have less of a benefit as a result of being in the DC plan than they would have had with the DB plan. The DB plan is designed with some efficiencies that it's kind of a rigged game. It's hard to get the same benefits because of the efficiencies of the DB plan. So that's something to keep in mind. And I talked about the integrity of the trust. Group integrity, benefits equity, you would have two plans, people that are similarly situated, working side by side, one's in a DB plan, one's in a DC plan. So, you know, that could be an issue equity-wise. Looking at people retention, and that's the fourth bullet, competitiveness and retention equity, or integrity, I'm sorry. Members that are still active in the plan, SPARB and the system went back and looked at the people who participate in the DC plan versus people in the DB plan, how many are still around. So looking at the people who joined the plan, the blue is the DC, the red is the DB. You can see that over 14 years and 10 years, more people have remained in the DB plan than have remained in the DC plan. Now, there are a variety of factors why that would be. You also notice that in the past 5 years, more people have stayed in the DC plan versus the DB plan. It's generally believed that a DB plan does better in retaining people, because that DB benefit, people, after they get around a certain point, they see the DB benefit and they start counting down the days to, okay, when I get to 25 years, I'm going to retire and, you know, get the calendar and start Xing it. That works a little bit better with a DB plan than a DC plan. But as you can see, there are a lot of different moving parts, so that's just one thing, food for thought. Purchasing power, integrity of the trust, preservation of benefits, portability, ancillary benefits, just clicking through those. Ancillary benefits are death benefits and disability benefits. DB plans are a nice, efficient mechanism
to provide death and disability benefits to active employees, and they're often used for that. So in addition to retirement benefits, they also have death benefits or disability benefits. A defined contribution plan is really just a balance, and unless you come up with an alternative arrangement outside the plan, the death benefit or the disability benefit is really just the balance. So if a person passes away, their balance is what they get as a death benefit. It's different than a disability income benefit or a spousal death income benefit. Now, there are ways around that. You could, you know, buy a supplemental plan, or you could try and annuitize the benefits in some way. But that's something to keep in mind. If you still want to provide ancillary benefits from the new defined contribution plan, you're going to have to work a little bit harder and think about it. Portability, on the flip side, defined contribution plans are a lot more portable. So taking them with you is a lot easier. And this is a, you know, the debate is whether that keeps people around, or if people see that money and they want to leave and they take it with them. But DC benefits as opposed to DB benefits are a lot more portable. There's no question about it. Preservation of benefits, I mentioned a little bit, and purchasing power, I'll skip. The actuarial impacts, we already talked about. The investment impacts, I think he discussed. One thing I would mention is that the cash flow is something that has to be monitored, because the plan has immediately less people contributing to it, and the benefits payments are staying more or less the same. Cash flow is more of an issue. So you have to worry about, okay, do we have enough cash on hand to make our payments? And that might involve changing the asset allocation, selling equities or selling something else to have the cash to make those benefit payments made. So that's something that these guys are experienced in dealing with.
Chairman.
Senator Triplett.
Just a technical point here, since we're on technical issues. My hard copy is not tracking with yours. It's like 2 pages off. Did you revise it and add a couple pages?
It was revised, and I don't know what pages were added. But
okay, we're like 2 pages off from yours. I'm just
Senator Triplett, are you looking at the letter or the PowerPoint presentation?
Looking at the PowerPoint presentation.
Why am I tracking right and I'm on the letter?
we're going through the letter more or less point by point.
Oh, okay. So maybe I'm just on the wrong one then.
And there are several versions of this, so they may be that we have an old one. If something looks really strange, though, let me know. If it contradicts anything I say.
Which numbers refer to the letter?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. These page numbers here refer to the letter.
I'm talking about the little page numbers.
Oh, the page numbers on the bottom or not. Okay.
Oh,
okay.
I'm following that.
Okay. Well, I apologize for that. The technical issues, implementation issues, they're detailed in the letter. I won't go into them too much detail. One issue, big issue, is employee communication. What you tell the participants, do you give them their options? You know, here's what it is under the DB plan. Here's what you would get under the DC plan. Disclosure is obviously very important there. And education is important. You know, a DC plan has a different threshold for managing your money. People are responsible for managing their own money if there's a, you know, a directed investment. So people will have to be educated, or you want to educate people. You want to give them the best chance they have at managing their investments. Fiduciary issues. I think the big fiduciary issues are really regarding the trust. You know, whether the trust will be managed the same way, and DC plans have their own host of fiduciary issues that are different than DB plans, so you're going to need to address those. Of course, there's always possible legal issues. Whenever a large public sector plan changes, there are always lawsuits that come out of it, so you know, that's something to keep in mind. And then the long-term costs are something that, you know, we'll always be keeping our eye on. So that is all I have at this time.
Questions? Representative Hake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anything in the bill that's being proposed that requires that we notify the potential employees that if they decide to stay in the defined benefit plans, because 40% of them could be leaving, they might be paying a much larger contribution? Is there anything required about that, or are they under the assumption that it's going to stay the same if the state doesn't fully fund it?
I don't believe that the bill specifies any kind of disclosure, but that's an excellent point.
Other questions? I believe that in the Government Services Committee, the point was made that the unfunded liability would be $3.6 billion. What is the number now that equates to that?
Valuation report. I don't, unfortunately, I don't have the valuation report, but I think we could look at the GASB number. We'll get that number for you. I apologize, I don't have it at my fingertips.
It's likely less than that, though, because of...
Here it is. The statutory, it's on page 3 of the report. And so if you go to item number, the dot highlight, the second one there, where it says, if the statutory contribution rate is not adjusted or a transfer of assets into the fund is not made, the main system's assets that are allocated to state employees are projected to be exhausted in 2049, assuming an 8% return and 40% transfers. At that point in time, the remaining unfunded liability is projected to be $1.19 billion. At 7%, the plan would be out of money in 2041 with an unfunded liability of $1.7 billion. At 6%, the projected exhaustion date is 2037. With an unfunded liability of $2.1 billion. At 5%, the fund will be out of money in 2034 with an unfunded liability of $2.5 billion. At 4%, the exhaustion date is 2033 with an unfunded liability of $2.8 billion. So if there was no more money that came into the fund and this bill was passed, and you pick what you assume that return date is going to be. If 8's too strong, if you say it's 6, at 6, we will be out of money in 2037, and there will be $2.1 billion that will have to be paid by the employer on a pay-as-you-go basis. Remember, that's how we ended up doing OASIS. It was on a pay, except that time we were talking $8,000 or $9,000. Here you'd be talking at 6%, 2.1 billion that would have to be assessed, appropriated everybody, a portion of that appropriated everybody any of going forward.
So the proposal is to put money into a separate fund. How does that look from an accounting point of view?
Well, that's,
does the pension plan indicate that liability with the note?
But you know what, the closest thing we talked to our other firm, Ide Helmicke, about this. Is California set up a retirement stabilization fund on their own. But it wasn't because they were closing the plan. It was just to deal with, you know, fluctuations so they didn't have to go back and increase the employer contribution. And they asked whether that stabilization fund could be counted on the financial statements as retirement funding in determining for the Governmental Accounting Standards Board's requirements. And no, because it's a general asset. That's the main issue you have here. That if it's not in the trust fund, it's not set aside as in the retirement trust. It's a general asset of the employer. And there's no guarantees. Basically, what's being replaced here is it's kind of like what you do with Social Security. And Social Security today, there's, you know, what the government didn't put the money in. What they did is they put in there a promissory note. What's being done here is the money's not going into the fund. It's being said, look, there's a promise here, or there isn't even an explicit promise in legislation. There's an implicit intent that someday maybe we'll transfer money out of here over to here if you need it.
And in the trust fund, it would be untouchable, but in the other fund, it could be used for some other purpose.
And the closest analogy to that is like with the 457 money, that's their supplemental retirement savings program. At one point in time, those were set aside. That's kind of like the 401k plan of the public sector. And we've got lots of money in there, employees putting in there. That used to be considered a general asset of the employer. And back in the 90s, two California employers were looking at going broke. These employees at that time were at risk of losing all of that to the creditors. Well, that prompted action at the federal government to say, look, this has got to be put into a trust. And so, you know, now that's been put aside into a trust fund, so it's not subject to the general assets. This funding mechanism, if it would be set up this way, would not be consistent with ERISA, as pointed out here. You couldn't do this in the private sector because the money's not going into the trust. And the other question you had here that just takes, that the number of people that would leave, would it be zero, would it be 40, would it be 80? Last time when we ran it in 1999, when the market was doing great, we had 38% that left. Now this time it could be higher, because we're going to be giving them an opportunity to make that election in 2016. And what employees will know in 2016 is that their plan is out of course to running out of money. Because you'll, you know, no, it won't be until after the 2017 session that you could actually transfer money in.
My guess is that employees that would opt to be to move to the defined contributions would more likely be employees earlier in their career. Would that be a fair assumption, or?
I think that'd be a good assumption. But you do have, again, you go back when they would be given the opportunity to do this. You know, their fund, I mean, because once this bill is passed, all your reports, actuarial reports, and your financial reports are going to show the plan running out of money. And so that's what they will know, is that there isn't any money there. Now, if you met your retirement date, there is some strong feeling that you can feel legally secure that that will have to be provided. So, you know, long-term employees that have met their normal retirement date might have more confidence than those that haven't met their date.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Collins, I have a follow-up to something you just said. So if the bill were to be amended to put the effective date of it further down the road so that there could be a funding mechanism in place before people were required to make their election, then would your estimate be still in the range of the 38% to 40% as the likelihood of leaving the plan?
It probably could be lower.
Okay.
I mean, because once people are confident that the plan has been funded, then they would probably be able to make, I mean, our election rates today are very low.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I don't see any other questions. Do we have anybody else that would like to speak to this? Seeing none, then I think we're ready for a motion. If somebody would like to step out. Or a favorable recommendation? Is there a second? We have a motion and a second. Motion by Senator O'Connell, second by Representative Lauzer for a favorable recommendation of Bill Number 176, also known as Senate Bill 2038. Is there any further discussion? This is a big issue coming into the session. It has long-term implications. So I think we need to be prepared to have a major conversation on it during the session. So, any discussion? Seeing none, we'll ask Council to call the roll.
Senators Kilzer.
Aye.
Krebsbaugh.
Yes.
O'Connell.
Aye.
Pullman.
Aye.
Triplett. Representative Vigasa.
Yes.
Boehning.
Yes.
Robin.
Yes.
Doctor.
Yes.
Hake.
No.
Lauzer.
Yes.
Onsted?
No.
And Senator Dever?
No.
Motion does carry.
Okay, the motion is carried, so Senate Bill 2038 will move forward with a favorable recommendation. And we have one item left on our agenda, bill draft number 117. Representative Casper. Oh, wait a minute. 403.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say the bill number I have is a little bit different.
Yeah, we had another one on the agenda.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Representative Jim Casper, wanting to visit with you about bill draft number 15.0403.0100. This had to do with the PERS ability to obtain competitive quotes for health insurance. And the bill is very simple. If you go to page 2, line 8, the bill would amend current statute and allow the following. Regardless of whether the board chooses to self-insure, the board may develop a provider network by negotiating and contracting with health care providers and associations. A provider network developed under this subsection may only be used by the board or an insurance company contracting with the board to provide health insurance coverage pursuant to this chapter. In the business of health insurance, when an insurance company is engaged with a client, whether it's North Dakota PERS or whether it's in the private sector, the insurance company reimburses claims to the providers based upon the provider contract that that insurance company has signed with the providers. So these are called preferred provider networks, and each insurance company that does business in North Dakota has access to a network. The problem is that when you do have little or no business in North Dakota and you would like to enter into business in North Dakota, you have no preferred provider network or contracting, and therefore you as that insurance company, take Cigna as an example, must rent a network from somebody who has a network already in North Dakota. So you pay an additional fee to rent the network that's in place. So the advantage to companies who do business in North Dakota now and have a provider network in place is that they generally would have a reduced amount of reimbursement that they pay for the same claim. As an example, an appendectomy, let's just say that the provider would bill the insurance carrier $1,000 for that appendectomy. I know the numbers aren't correct, but just for illustrative purposes. So the bill is $1,000. The contract that the provider has negotiated says the provider will accept $700, and that's what's paid by the insurance carrier to the provider. If you're a provider that does not have your own contract, your reimbursement level might be $750, it might be $800, it could be the full $1,000. And so when we're looking for bids for the North Dakota PERS health insurance plan, many national carriers do not bid in North Dakota because they are at a disadvantage without a preferred provider network. This bill simply says that PERS could negotiate with the providers in North Dakota and develop a PERS network so that any carrier that wished to compete in North Dakota would be able to utilize the PERS network that is in place, so all the carriers could use the same network, and that PERS would negotiate a discount off of that contract that the provider would need to use to reimburse. So the bottom line in this bill is it would, in my opinion, open up competition for our health insurance plan in the North Dakota PERS system, which, if we can open up competition and potentially have lower claims that we're reimbursing, we could save the taxpayers of the state of North Dakota some money. So this is about opening up competition, not stifling competition. It's about allowing PERS to have in place a network that any company that wishes to bid in North Dakota would be able to use that network in place. And the key to the bill also is we looked at this a couple of sessions ago, maybe three sessions ago, is PERS could not use their network for any other companies or any other employers in North Dakota. It has to stay only with PERS for the PERS health insurance plan. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that's the essence of the bill.
and I hope that it would be favorably considered by the committee. I think it's good for the taxpayers, it's good for competition, it's good for our employees who are involved with the PERS health insurance plan.
Are there any questions? Representative Onstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Casper, what would be the negotiating part between two different insurance companies? Let's use the $700. So does that become negotiable in whether or not this becomes a working part of their offer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Onstad, every insurance company that does business in North Dakota negotiates these provider contracts every year, and so they might have 4,000 or 5,000 touch points where they have fees set in their contracts, and so it's a negotiation with the insurance company and the provider. Generally speaking, those costs go up every year, but depending upon the amount of business you might have in our state, they may stay stable, and I can't see where they might go down, but they would but could potentially be less of an increase. So each provider, each insurance company has a proprietary contract that is their contract that is. So company A would have one reimbursement schedule, company B would have another, company C would have another. So again, as the focus of and the intent of the bill is to allow these national insurance companies who have millions of people insured in other states besides North Dakota to be able to come to North Dakota and use the PERS network so that they could compete.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Casper, have you run this idea by the PERS board, and do you know what their attitude is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, as you can see, Sparv is here, and I discussed the bill with him. He and I certainly want him to speak for himself, but he has not had board approval yet. The idea came too quickly between board meetings, but I think it's his intent to seek approval from the board, but I don't believe at this time that's been secured.
And if I may follow up, I see that you have it drafted as using may instead of shall, so it doesn't require the board to do anything at this point. It's a permissive sort of adoption of a new network.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, correct.
Okay.
It's up to the PERS board to make the decision whether or not they wish to implement.
Thank you.
Senator Kilzer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Casper, if this would be expanded beyond PERS, and I assume it probably would be considered in the future, would the state insurance commissioner weigh in on this? Would this, put a little restrictions on him? And my other thought is one of the things that we really need in healthcare insurance is, and was brought out in the Obamacare debate, was about crossing state lines and things like that. So if you could just address those two topics briefly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kilzer. The bill is explicit. It prohibits the board from using their network with any other plan besides the PERS board. That's number one. So it would only be for the PERS plan. Number two, you're right, Senator Kilzer. There's always discussion of how can we get insurance companies to cross state lines and do business in other states. This would be an opportunity for those insurance carriers out there in the world of insurance in the United States to be able to have an opportunity to compete for the North Dakota business. But again, this bill pertains only to the North Dakota PERS plan. They prohibited from using it for any other employer in North Dakota, just the PERS plan.
Other questions? Seeing none, it is the interest of this committee to consider bills that have an impact with PERS, retirement, and health that's either negative or positive, and your suggestion is this would be positive.
Mr. Chairman, I am. If we look at the potential cost savings, when you have, from my perspective, And again, I think most of you know I am in the insurance business and I sell health insurance. From my perspective, when you have more companies that are willing to bid for a plan, the competition enhances the sharpening of the pencil. And so I think the potential is here that dollars could be saved for the citizens and the taxpayers of the state of North Dakota and our employees for their out-of-pocket costs that they incur when they have their co-pays and their deductibles. So that's the goal, and that's my intent.
Okay. Thank you. Was there anyone else wanting to speak to this bill? Seeing none, then I think the proper motion from the committee would be to take jurisdiction of bill draft number 403 and submit it for actuarial consideration. A motion by Senator Triplett. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Representative Vigasaw. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, ask in a roll call. Ask council to call the roll.
Senator Stever?
Yes.
Hilzer?
Aye.
Grebsbaugh?
Aye.
O'Connell?
Aye.
Pullman?
Aye.
Triplett?
Aye.
Representatives Vigasaw?
Yes.
Boehning?
Yes.
Robin?
Yes.
Doctor?
Yes.
Hake?
Aye.
Lauser?
Yes.
And Onsted? Motion carries.
Motion is carried. This will then go to the actuary, and I assume will be back to us before the beginning of the session. How would the committee feel about having a meeting the morning of the 6th of January when the session begins at noon?
We'll be here.
Would that fit for everybody? I think we'll probably plan to do that.
10 o'clock.
Yeah, it takes me about 10 minutes to get here, so that should work. So with that, I think for now we're adjourned and 4 minutes ahead of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.